Special Committee on Energy was convened at 8:02 a.m. The following House members are present today: Co-Chair Millett, Representative Higgins, Hughes, Josephson, and Nagyak, and myself, Representative Isaacson. I'd like to introduce the staff today. The House Recording Secretary on my right is Debbie Tillinghast, and Alex Giudice is our LIO moderator. Co-Chair Millett's Committee 8 is Jeff Turner, and my Committee 8 is Dave Tallarico to my left. Again, before we get started, if we can...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
I'm about to recognize
Okay, thank you.
Please silence your cell phones. All right, so during the first hour today, we're going to hear House Bill 39, an act relating to the Power Cost Equalization Program, and with us today also is Representative Bryce Hedgman and his staff, and they will do the presenting. Then during the second hour, we'll have a discussion on the Renewable Energy Projects Overview presented by Sarah Fisher Goad of the Alaska Energy Authority. She's the Executive Director, and Sean Scaling. And also, you know, when we're talking about HB 39, I just want to say that we're anticipating additional public hearings and other information. So I'd like to ask committee members that today we just hear and hold the bill, and we'll work on it as well later. One of the things I want to point out with today's meeting, the two different conversations, we're talking about power cost equalization, which affects a large swath of geographic Alaska. And then we've got the Alaska Energy Authority here. Oftentimes, we work on projects. We've heard a lot of different projects, Cook Inlet, Fairbanks, and so forth. And our projects oftentimes define our strategies. What we in this committee really want to concentrate on, I hope, is that we would have our strategies informed by policy. And so AEA is here talking about policy. Co-Chair Millett has talked about bills that this committee has passed in the past, and we need to be looking at what policies should govern our energy approach, or approach to getting affordable energy throughout Alaska, so that we do it in a way that maximizes opportunity and not just spends the dollars. I want to recognize also that Representative Foster has joined us. So at this time, if Representative Edgman, you and your staff would like to come forward, and please recognize yourselves for the record, and we'll begin.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman. I represent House District 36 in Southwest Alaska.
And is that microphone on?
Can you hear me?
Now
I need to get a little bit closer. And with me is my staff, Tim Clark, this morning as well. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'd like to thank you very much for hearing House Bill 39. Really appreciate you taking the subject up. I think it's no secret, in particular to this committee, that the costs of energy in Alaska have been, and I would put it very nicely, problematic in the last X amount of years. And we're particularly in outlying areas that are dependent on diesel, the cost of energy, I think over time, and as a rural legislator, along with Representative Foster and Representative Nagyak and others, yourself, Mr. Chairman, it is having a cumulative effect. There's no question about it. I think we're seeing it in the demographics of our smaller communities in particular, some of our villages. And I saw this past fall while I was on the trail. It is impacting the composition of who stays in the villages, who moves to the hubs, who moves to South Central Alaska, who moves to where there's natural gas, and it's cheaper to, you know, survive in a household where you're not having to dedicate 40% to 50% of your costs just to keep the place warm and the lights on. Now, as a rural legislator, and I've had the good fortune of being on this committee before, my approach to energy has always been two-pronged. One is certainly always to keep the eye on the longer term. I mean, everything from the gas line down to large hydroelectric projects or high voltage lines that may be in place, everything that the Renewable Energy Grant Fund and the Alaska Energy Authority is doing vis-a-vis alternative and renewable energy sources. that's all very important and something that we must not lose sight of in particular as we get into an area here of having to scrutinize agency budgets and probably have to roll back spending. Very difficult choices along the way. But at the same time, the short term, the here and now, the present, with a lot of villages, as I spoke to a moment ago, who are really just sort of buckling in under the cost of energy. Fortunately, I think the legislature, and to the governor's credit in his current budget, the legislature, I think, has really tried hard to do things. We put a lot of money into energy programs in the last 5 to 6 to 7 years. We put hundreds of millions of dollars into the weatherization program, home energy rebate program. We've taken community revenue sharing, and we've ramped that up. In particular, the last couple of years, we've added money to the education funding formula. We've put, I think, significant money in the renewable energy grant fund, and so on and so forth. So I think we've done our part, but yet I'm here before you with this bill, House Bill 39, to suggest that I think we can even do more to bridge a gap from where we are today to where we hopefully are going to be tomorrow once we have a gas line in place. And, you know, I'll just, you know, I've always, my philosophy has always been that the great equalizer for energy in Alaska probably is going to be natural gas. I mean, it'll be tempered and supported and supplemented by other forms of energy, hopefully in the renewable end of things, and certainly conservation and efficiency along the way. But by and large, when it comes right down to it, for a state that's got so few economies of scale and it's such a high-cost environment, it's probably going to be natural gas. That's my outlook, at least anyway. But real quickly, before I get to the nuts and bolts of this bill, and I'm going to try to do that briefly as well. The PC program, you know, as we know it today, basically started in the early 80s. The concern about power and providing equalized access to sources of power has been around a long time in the legislature. And the PC program started approximately in 1980, 81. In 1984, it became the program more to what we know today, the Power Cost Equalization Program. It reached its peak in 1999, when at that point the program was providing for residential users about 700 kilowatt hours of power a month, and it also provided for commercial entities to be on the program. But the cost was getting pretty exorbitant. So a Blue Ribbon Commission was formed. And they surmised that in order to keep the program going and viable, and you know, keep in mind this was an era when oil prices were tapering off and we were looking at the downsizing as much of government as possible, the program was scaled back to 500 kilowatt hours a month for residential users, and the commercial users were essentially removed. But a certain portion of the community facilities were allowed to stay in the program, and that's defined in statute as well. So from 1999 to where we are today, just in summary fashion here, a PC endowment fund was established, and now after a number of capitalizations is around $785 million, give or take, with the market value. residential users enjoy the PC program now up to 500 kilowatt hours a month. There are a number of communities, smaller villages, that don't get anywhere close to that 500 kilowatt hour threshold. And I would point out that because a lot of these smaller villages in our districts don't have washers and dryers and don't have the appliances that people would enjoy in the urban areas, you know, the average usage, according to the ICER report that was done last year for the PC program, is about 333 kilowatt hours a month to maybe 500, somewhere around that, for the 190 or so utilities that participate in the program, whereas in urban Alaska, you get more between 600 and 700 kilowatt hours of average consumption, and you know, certainly no knocking anybody in urban Alaska. I mean, if you've got the cheaper power, you tend to use it, right? So what House Bill 39 would do is it would take that 500 kilowatt hour threshold for residential users and bump it up to 600 kilowatt hours, and it would also bring in a small amount, according to the AAA's fiscal note. They forecast about 25% of the commercial users that would be under the cap of 2,400 kilowatt hours a month. So,
Representative, if you would, explain the rationale. If the average is 333 kilowatts per month in the bush, why would you need to boost it to 600 kilowatts?
Mr. Chairman, it's a range between 333 and 500, and that's dispersed over, you know, all of the communities that are in rural Alaska. And there's a very lengthy report that I got to read during a nine-hour floor session we had last year. And,
me too.
That's the Blue Ribbon report.
No, this is actually a report that was conducted by the Institute of Social and Economic Research. I don't know if you have.
And what's the date of that report, if you
it's
would?
It's March of 2012.
March of 2012.
Yeah.
And that's in our packet?
Okay. Apparently, Mr. Chairman, it's not in your packet, but we can furnish it to the committee.
If you would, thank you.
Get it online, too.
Okay.
Mr.
Foster, Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but is part of the findings that average and that range is lower on average because the cost of energy is higher out there, so people just can't afford to be spending as much, and therefore that's the range is smaller for that reason.
Through the chair, Representative Foster, I think that's exactly correct. In some communities, the ceiling on the PC program right now, the floor actually is the average of power paid in Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage. I think everybody's probably familiar with that. And the legislature a few years ago upped the ceiling to a dollar amount. So those communities that pay within that range of, I guess it's 14 cents now on the floor at present and a dollar in statute. So those communities that are in that range, enjoy the benefits of the PC program. But some communities, as you say, pay so much power, it's far and above a dollar. That you've got a natural conservation element built in where people just simply don't use power because they can afford it.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then you're talking about raising this from 500 to 600, and I guess just for a little bit of history, last year I was also on the Energy Committee, and we had also looked at, I believe, raising it to 700, including maybe health clinics and schools, and so I think this bill was an effort to try and do what we could, realizing that we're also under a great deal of fiscal restrictions in terms of what we could do and the cost of what that would be. And so this was an effort to try and. So am I correct though? Is that or am I missing any component of what was in there and what was kicked out?
Through the chair, Representative Foster, again, you're accurate. The bill, when it started out last year, essentially was a full meal deal, and we basically tailored it in large part to what the program was in 1999, although scaling back the commercial side of things. But in going through the committee process and getting the endowment forecasts and certainly the demand side as well from AEA, we scaled the bill back because, in order for this program to go into effect, were it to go into effect, let's say this year, it would require extra money. There's no question about that. But over time, it would require less money as the endowment grows. And we can talk about that more in the fiscal note. But, Mr. Chairman, I guess I would just make the other point that, there's no pretenses. This bill provides sort of marginal benefits to consumers. It's not the sort of, what a gas line would provide in terms of from top to bottom relief that all of our consumers, South Central as well, will be needing here at some point.
And on that point, if you would, in the interior and much of the especially higher latitude rural areas, the major cost isn't really electricity at all. It's heating. 60% of the Fairbanks region cost is space heating or thermal heating. How true is that in the rural areas affected by PCE?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the numbers are every bit as staggering. They really are. You look at some communities that don't get barge deliveries in the fall, that have to get their fuel flown in. That 60% could go even higher. With the price of oil where it's at, it's providing us relief down here for those of us putting the budget together for all of us as legislators. Back in our districts, it certainly has a counter effect of producing very high prices. And if you live in any community that has a fuel truck that comes to your house, you'll know what the Grim Reaper looks like for sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into the nuts and bolts, then, of this bill, if you okay. would.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, the bill itself is pretty straightforward. Let me see if I can just do it in about three or four sentences. Again, it would increase on the residential side the monthly benefit from 500 kilowatt hours to 600 kilowatt hours. On the commercial side, it would bring back in the commercial users into the program, but only at a cap of those that use 2,400 kilowatt hours or less a month. And they, too, would enjoy a benefit of up to 600 kilowatt hours under the PC program. But it has to be a small business. And that's a more significant impact of this bill because it's a lot of our small businesses, the mom and pops, that really, you know, the local store in a small village that really are sort of keeping the, you know, any sort of local services or being able to provide perishable goods to our communities that would fall under this. And it was, if anything, more of an impetus for this bill than on the residential side, which, again, 100 kilowatt hours of extra PC benefits, you know, for some, maybe a big benefit. For others, you know, again, in the margin as opposed to sort of across the board benefits that the bill would provide. And, you know, if I could, I would ask my staff, but I think that is the bill, and it's a sum total, Mr. Chairman.
And so I take it that Mr. Clark is going to be presenting some of the other data that you have in here. One of the most intriguing things, especially for the committee to understand, is prior to 2000, when before the census changed, this legislature was supporting businesses and residents with power cost equalization. And there was out-migration from the rural areas. But after 2000 to 2000, well, to present, the businesses have been excluded. And so we have seen a huge out-migration because employers cannot keep their doors open if they're competing with the lowest cost possibilities. And so when people are pinched, the businesses lay off employees, the employees have no money, they're thrown onto the state, and so they leave for better opportunities. Is that roughly the reason for this? Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, it's just good to keep in mind that what happened in 1999 and the impetus for changing that PCE, and Bryce was Representative Edgman was here during that time, was that oil dropped to, I can't remember what the barrel, $9 a barrel of oil. So it wasn't a choice that anybody in the legislature went into willingly. It was a force of nature based on a budgetary decision. It wasn't because we didn't like commercial businesses or that we didn't see the need. It was a financial decision that we had to make, which, again, we're at that point in time again where our oil revenues are going to be declining, the throughput's going to be declining. So when we talk about, you know, adding a program to the budget, everybody has to be cognizant of what our future revenues will be. And so I was most pleased and most pleased with the legislature's foresight in the endowment fund. That was something that was, you know, Senator Hoffman and Representative Edgman and Representative Foster took the lead on. And so that endowment fund, as it grows, you're right, will produce more opportunities for, you know, leveling the energy costs, which really isn't a good description of this because it doesn't level the energy costs at all. But so I just wanted to give a little history. It wasn't because we didn't like commercial. I mean, it was a subject of budgeting. An opportunity for what we had was cash.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might respond, first to your point, you know, I'm somebody who's been in and out of this building for over 20 years, and you know, for the whole gamut of rural legislators that have come and gone, we've always argued that there's a symbiotic relationship between the hubs in Alaska and the outlying communities, mm-hmm. and it's an economic relationship as well as cultural and social and every other aspect. To Representative Millett's point, you know, I'm under no illusions that this bill is going to, you know, beat the cruise ship bill to the governor's desk. So, that you know, I'm hoping to get more debate on the bill and along the way also use it as a vehicle to highlight you know, the perilous situation that I think exists in a lot of our communities. And I would, you know, here in 2013, looking at Representative Millett from Anchorage, and Anchorage isn't that far behind us either. I mean, this whole energy challenge is going to be more statewide in scope than it's ever been before. So,
thank you. Representative Foster and then Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to back up for a moment to the average consumption. Is that, I assume that was a year round, and I'm just wanting to, you've got a summer and a winter, and I'm just wondering if that's reflective of what people would use in the winter when they're plugging in their circulating pump, they're plugging in possibly heat trace to thaw out pipes, and they've got, you know, maybe plugging in a vehicle and you know, just things of that nature. What else do I have here? You know, maybe, you know, electric heaters possibly. And so I didn't know if, you know, when it's maybe most needed, because in the winter you've got folks who are, you know, trying to pay for their heat bill. At the same time, you've got an electric bill, and so you're using more electric during the winter. And so I just was curious what that number might be during the winter.
Tim, Mr. Chairman.
My name is Tim Clark, staff representative, Edgman, and my understanding is that that average rural customer's usage is calculated for a full year's average usage, and it is, in fact, very difficult, if not impossible, in a lot of communities to stay below the cap during those winter months. And that is, in fact, likely where the small increment that, would be of significant help to an individual, to a residential user.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may add, the report does break down by regions of the state as well as intervals and the seasons and so forth. And it's some 80 pages in length. It's a bit of a read, but it's well worth it. I would certainly recommend it.
Excellent. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Edgman, I appreciate the concern that you bring. I used to live out in the bush, and I understand it, but I'm also very concerned about the fiscal note, which I'm sure you'll be addressing specifically. But I was wondering, I realized, and I leaned over to my colleague here from Fairbanks, I'm wondering how many residents in the state are eligible, and are they all in the rural off-the-road system, or does it include a place like Fairbanks, just so I get an idea. And the other thing I was wondering if you could provide is a sample a utility bill from a resident who, after the $500 is paid, what kind of bill they're left with. And I guess another thing I really need to understand, and I apologize, I don't know how the PCE program works exactly, but is the 500 kilowatts just subtracted from, you know, their usage and they don't have to pay for that, or are they provided a check, or is that sent to the utility company? Just the logistics of how it works with the PCE program, if you could explain.
Mr. Chairman, it might be, if the committee would agree, might be better in terms of mechanics of the program to allow Alaska Energy Authority to kind of walk you through that. In terms of a monthly billing statement, I was thinking about that this morning as I was walking into Capitol, that I wish I had my monthly billing statement in Dillingham, because I could show you what that impact is. We have a sort of a smaller house, so there's you know, about two-thirds, well, about half the year that we don't even get to the 500 kilowatt-hour rate cap. I mean, we're pretty conservation-minded, but there are during the winter months when the PC benefit provides us about a third of our bill, and that's significant, but that's more during the higher use months in the summertime. And there was a third part that you had your question that I might have missed.
Well, can
the chair?
Can you tell us if they're covering a third, then what does the two thirds look like? Do you mind telling us about what that is?
Well, it's my wife has been paying the bills the last couple of years. I haven't been. I'm down here. But it's at least several hundred dollars. But our community in Dillingham, because we're a bigger community, we've got more efficient generators. We've got a utility that's probably more modern than some of the smart communities, has been able to provide us the lower power rates, the kilowatt hour rates in the 40 cents range, or the low 40 cents range without the PC benefit. whereas it's the norm for a number of other communities to be way in excess of 50 cents a kilowatt hour rate. So that bill, if you were to bring in a consumer from Hooper Bay or up north in Representative Nagyak's district, which outside of Barrow uses the PC program probably at the highest level, would be much higher than what I just described to you about my bill in Dillingham.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. For part of the year, you're paying a couple hundred dollars. So what are you paying them the rest of the year for the utilities? What would be an average?
It can easily double, and it's more than a couple hundred. It's 300 plus or so a month for our place in Dillingham.
Okay.
And that's just in electricity alone.
And then my other question was about the residents. And is it just those off the road system? Does it include a place like Fairbanks? How does that? Well, you had said the department, I guess, could answer that, but
I'm going to, through the chair, I'm going to go off of memory here, and I may be corrected by Alaska Energy Authority, but it's some 190 utilities. I think it may be less. Sarah was describing yesterday. How many communities? About 185 communities, and it does exclude Fairbanks.
Right. And if, just real briefly, Fairbanks is one of the three communities that comprise the average that's used to base the formula for PC. And that will get more from AEA, but the three communities are Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. Representative Miller.
Kutcher, as I said, I think because we have so many new members on the Energy Committee, it might be worth our time to take 2 hours and actually go through the PCE one meeting. We've done that previously. It's a complicated formula. It's the history of PCE in the state of Alaska is interesting, and I think it will give us a much better background as we hold Representative Edgeman's bill, get a better grasp on what PCE is for those of us that have been here or that are very familiar with the program because our communities use it. I think that maybe in between the next time we hear Representative Edgeman's bill, it would be wise to have someone come back, whether AEA or Department of Revenue or whoever we want to come back and explain the PCE program much better instead of debating the
hodgepodge here.
Right, and then that way you make better decisions when it comes to what Representative Edgeman is proposing. And I will say that having the endowment fund completely changes the dynamics of the PCE fund because it's not so much a GF expenditure as it is a percentage of market value of a fund that was created, through great thought and hopefully will keep growing and when we talk about fiscal responsibility, that's exactly what the fund was set up for, so we didn't get into those high oil prices, low oil prices, and budgetary crisis that we still have money for PCE.
So we will we'll schedule that, and so let's hold off on questions on nuts and bolts and also for the endowment for that meeting. So today let's concentrate in the next half hour on the nuts and bolts of the bill in front of us. And if your question or comment is to that,
the endowment, Mr. Chairman.
Do you want to hold off until we discuss the endowment?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So you have a half an hour. Let's rip through the nuts and bolts. You have a lot of information that you attached, and so take it away.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if we could turn to the fiscal note, I'm going to give a 100,000-foot view level on the fiscal note. I think AEA will certainly give a more detailed look at it, and my staff, I would ask to chime in if that's okay along the way. But on the first page, the fiscal note shows to you that under the service lines that there would be an additional accounting tech position added were this bill to go into effect. Under grants and benefits, you see the additional amount of money it would take to actually accommodate the additional uses under or the expanded program under House Bill 39. And on the fund source, you can see what would come from the general fund and what would come from the PC endowment, again, with the expanded program in place. The next page, under the narrative, under item number one, you can see what the residential use portion would be broken down. That's about a third of that $20 million in additional cost each year. And then under number two, using the Alaska Energy Authority's estimate of 25% of the commercial entities out in the PC communities qualifying, that would comprise about two-thirds of that additional $20 million in extra money needed to fund the program. And Tim, do you want to provide any more detail? That's basically the fiscal note right there.
Mr. Clark?
Chairman, I think that sums it up generally.
Okay. And certainly, Mr. Chairman, one last point is on the third page. I think you all have a third page there. There's a schedule of what the endowment projections out into the future looks like with and without Hospital 39.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, could we hold off? A couple of us don't seem to have a copy of the fiscal note.
All right. It's in the back of your packet.
It seems to be.
And it's probably after you see something from Crowley. And
Yeah.
Everyone found it?
We're good.
Okay.
Can you start again?
All right. Yeah. Go ahead and review that one more time to make sure everyone's
okay. Again, on the front page, you can see under the services line item, basically the cost of an additional position. It's an accounting tech position that would be needed under Hospital 39. Under the grants and benefit, you can see basically what it would cost each year to accommodate expanding the program under Hospital 39. Under fund sources, you can see a breakout between what would come from the state's general fund budget every year and what would come from the PC endowment fund over the years, if I have that correct. And that's for the increase in the increase that Hospital 39 would bring about. On the second page, there's a lot of information here. And again, I think AA will probably go into much more detail. But for our purposes now, under number one, where it says cost breakdown, that's basically an outline of what it would cost on the residential side of Hospital 39, all sort of estimates in terms of demand and so forth employed. So that's about a third of the additional cost that the bill would bring about, the $20 million each year. Then number two is factoring in the commercial use that Hospital 39 would create. And that's, again, AA estimates about 25% of all the small businesses in the PC eligible communities would fall under this bill.
25%. Questions? Representative Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Edgman, so my understanding is a larger store like the AC in Bethel or Dillingham would not get any subsidy.
That's correct. They would consume above and beyond 2,400 kilowatt hours a month.
All right, so this would be, if I could follow up, this would be more like the village store in Dalton.
Mm-hmm.
It might qualify.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Hughes.
If we stayed at the 500 kilowatt level, would the endowment fund be covering the program without the extra money from the GF?
Through the chair, it is expected, and I don't have those exact numbers that I might ask Tim to help me with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, this is Tim Clark, staff and Representative Richmond. Representative Hughes, through the chair, if I understand the projections for the endowment fund correctly, and also looking at the costs that are attributed or estimated, you know, solely for residential, the increased residential usage, it is conceivable that within a few years, the spinoff, you know, from the endowment fund could cover the entirety of the added commercial subsidy.
And as well, through the chair, I think what Representative Hughes was asking is what without Hospital 39, what time in the future would the endowment fund be able to fully support the PC program as we know it today? And that's that would be a few years out. And again, these are projections on the demand side and certainly prices and things like that. Mr. Chairman, maybe what might be most appropriate, given that time is dwindling here, so let AA come up and speak to that, and obviously much more authority than we're doing right now.
That'd be fine. Before they do, let's finish questions for you, and we'll go to Representative Nagyak and then Representative Josephson.
The endowment fund, is a one-time fund, or is it? Does it generate? Is it able to generate revenue? Use that revenue, store lot, or to use that, or how does it? How does the endowment fund work?
Through the chair, the endowment fund was actually started if I have my memory correct, in 2001, and through, I think it was three major appropriations, there was money that came from the Constitutional Budget Reserve, money came from the Railroad Energy Reserve in the early days, and then through additional appropriations, most recently here a couple of years ago, $400 million. It today sits at somewhere around the $800 million mark, depending on how the market is working. It's about $785 million right now, I think, is the latest number that we have. And it pays off a benefit on a rolling three-year average. Certainly everybody knows the permanent fund does a five-year average. This pays out at a three-year average. And I think the statutory requirement is for it to earn 7% a year, which in today's market environment is pretty darn good.
I've got that right.
Yeah. Close. So.
If you would, Representative Millett.
And there's nothing that prohibits the legislature from continuing to fund that endowment. I mean, so depending on if the finance committees contribute a larger amount to the endowment, knowing that the future benefit would be greater than continuing to draw from the general fund. The other thing that I want to mention too is we're at a point in time where the average calculation for PCE based on energy costs and Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau may go up considerably, depending on what happens in the rail belt with importation of LNG or some other significant increase to our costs. So that's also something to consider. That formula-based programs like that, we may see an increase in the program based on a calculation.
So. And so programmatic things like this, let's wait for until we have that presentation regarding PCE and endowment, because that could take the next couple hours, as we were talking about. And I know AEA does have a presentation, and Representative Edgman has asked if you, Ms. Fisher-Gold, would address some of the PCE. But let's just do it on the broad strokes at this moment, because otherwise we're going to run out of time. And we do want to give this its proper consideration. It's a appreciate you bringing this forward. It does highlight, and especially what Representative, our co-chair Millett, has said, and as you introduced this bill, times are changing in Alaska, and costs are going up, and the effectiveness of this program may be diminished because of the high cost of energy in communities like Fairbanks already, and Anchorage is starting to feel the pinch as well. And so that's going to affect the formula. So we've got to keep that in mind. Mr. Josephson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just something for Representative Edgman to think about, and maybe this isn't particularly as relevant as I think it might be, but it sort of follows up on something you said. It strikes me that if we're comparing apples to apples, we would need to know how much, what kilowatts are required for monitors and Toyo stoves, because they are not something you see in Juneau or Anchorage. You do in Fairbanks, I guess, but they are heat, space heat, thermal heat related, not light switches and washing machines. And if you could, or someone could find that out, that might be interesting to know. Like, what part of your bill in that you described in Dillingham comes from that usage?
Through the chair, I don't know that type of information exists. You know, the PCE-eligible communities are required to provide a monthly report that's pretty detailed that goes to both Alaska Energy Authority and the Regulatory Commission. So the utilities themselves are you know, governed by a pretty steady flow of information. At the household level, unless I'm mistaken, we haven't been able to find any of that in our research efforts.
Okay. All right. Mr. Foster?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you wanting to look for what the consumption is, the electrical consumption is for a space heating unit like a monitor? Is that?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I've got a utility bill for a fourplex, and it's just electrical for just to run the boiler there. And so, you know, one thing we could do is look at that and split that in four ways if it's a fourplex, and it kind of gives you some idea maybe. And I know that boilers and furnaces, I mean, you've got that electrode going, and yeah, it's creating that spark to fire off the oil. And
And it definitely uses a substantial amount of, I think, electricity. So anyway, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. We've got our work cut out for us. Go ahead and wrap it up, and we'll bring AEA.
Mr. Chairman, I would just conclude by saying thank you very much for hearing the bill, and really thank you for the interest, committee members. I think there's some really good questions.
Thank you, Representative Benjamin. Appreciate that. So at this time, we'll bring forward the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority, Sarah Fletcher Goad, and also Sean Scaling. Thank you. And it looks like you've got the primary mic. So if you would, before you get into the overview of renewable energy projects, if you could address some of the questions that were there just on the broad strokes for PC.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Sarah Fisher Goad. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. With respect to just a couple questions with regarding the endowment. The endowment is the most significant funding source for the PCE program currently. It is a combination of general fund and endowment, as the $400 million investment that was made a couple years ago works through the percent of market value formula, which is 3 years of the monthly average market value. With that, the fiscal note on page 3 of the fiscal note that provides a recap, it will show, assuming a 7% return per year, you can see the estimated value of that fund, and based upon the existing program, what could potentially be able to be reinvested. Now, there is a significant caveat to that, and I think Representative Edgman did mention this, that the endowment is actually statutorily required to earn 7% over time. It's not you really don't earn 7% every year, but it's invested in a manner to earn that over time. You know, similar to what you would see perhaps with the retirement fund. So it can't provide consistent earning. However, I believe it has been performing of that 7% over time, and so it is difficult to project that for fiscal note purposes and what that return would be. Some years the investment return has been significant. It's been well over 7%, but in recent years, as the markets have changed, that the return on that fund has been significantly lower. But again, the concept is to have that be a smoothing out process where you have some consistency, where those fluctuations in the market eventually provide you that consistent revenue available, the 7% available for the program, but you don't have these massive fluctuations each year. I should note, I think the Representative Edgman had provided some information. I thought that was pretty useful with respect to the use of that endowment on, I think, this one sheet of paper that talks about the earnings of the fund and some assumptions on either using 7% or 5% of the program. And assuming there is a consistent return on the endowment at the targeted statutory rate of 7%, if you use the 5% rate, it is about targeting what we currently estimate the program to cost. It's a little over $40 million per year for the existing program, not counting the changes that would be considered in House Bill 39. So with that, I think I probably, hopefully that was broad enough for you, Mr. Chairman, and I can answer some specific questions with respect to the fiscal note if there are any.
Thank you. And we'll bring you back for a more detailed, but in the meantime, Representative Hughes.
Yeah, I think this one is broad enough where we're not getting too particular. I'm just wondering the GF that's being added, is that to make up the difference to get us from the 500 to the 600 kilowatts in the bill? Or is the GF addition that is more to grow the endowment fund so that we can get that the smoothing out over time where we won't be having to add the GF each year? So is that additional GF specifically the difference that needs to be paid out to get us from the 500 to 600 this year?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, the fiscal note, the additional funds needed for the cost of the program of about $20.6 million, $6.3 million of that is estimated to be the increase from going to 500 to 600. The 14.3 is the estimated cost to include the commercial customers. So it's a bit of a combination. The general fund increase that's shown on the fiscal note covers that total increased cost. However, if you wanted to just look at the commercial portion of it, that would be on page 2 of the fiscal note. You would see that that would be the 14.3. If there was a change, that would only address the commercial and not increase the residential rate, our fiscal note cost would then would be reduced by that $6.3 million. So you would see that you would see that reflected in the cost and the funding needs.
All right. Thank you. And with that, we're going to conclude PC, and we're going to move on to the reason that you're here is talking about the Renewable Energy Fund and how that might also be a solution for much of Alaska.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we do have a presentation, and since we do have some limited time and there is a desire to really get into the Renewable Energy Fund, I'm going to quickly run through a couple of these slides that give a bit of an overview of AEA programs and then turn it over to Mr. Scaling to address the Alternative Energy and Renewable Energy Fund programs at the Alaska Energy Authority. So just in general, the Alaska Energy Authority, our mission is to reduce the cost of energy, and we have some very key programs that we do and strategies that we use in order to do this. We have an energy planning and policy requirement for the state of Alaska. We provide technical and community assistance. We do invest in Alaska's energy infrastructure. We do own and operate energy projects. And through programs such as the Renewable Energy Fund, we are diversifying Alaska's energy portfolio to help meet the state's renewable energy goal of 50% of renewable energy for electricity by 2025. So we did add a couple slides just to give a bit of perspective on electricity generation in the state. This is an opportunity just to see that, you know, in the railroad area that has 80% of the population, most of the generation is generated in the rail belt, and you can see then the lower loads in the rest of the state, with Southeast having approximately 12%, but the rest of the areas of the state only 2 or 1% of the entire load of the state. This was another slide that we thought was to demonstrate to the issues. And as we talked about the power cost equalization program, this is one area that you see this, where energy costs vary significantly through the state. You can see where Anchorage costs are significantly lower and almost the lowest. The costs that are actually lower than Anchorage are really in the large hydro areas in Southeast Alaska that include Juneau, and then Ketchikan, Wrangell, and Petersburg in particular. And then you can also see in the Fairbanks costs are although low for the rest of the state, are still significantly higher than even the Anchorage and some Southeast communities. And on the bar chart, we do show too that heating costs do obviously vary significantly through the state. And I know with this being the Energy Committee, I'm not really telling you anything you don't really know, but it's always nice to see graphically where the costs are. And of course, the rest of the state where there's high costs is also some of our lower populated areas of the state too.
And if I would, Ms. Fisher, many of us are new on the committee, and so all assumptions are off as far as what our knowledge base is. So go ahead and just tell us as if it was brand new at times.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So energy policy development coordination, we do have a deputy director of statewide energy policy development. That's Mr. Gene Terrio, former state senator, and he has been taking a lead with respect to the energy policy development in the state. There had been a desire to really see a very much more of a coordinated effort with energy planning and policy. So Gene, as part of our management team, has been working very very closely with other state agencies and communities with respect to developing energy policy issues in the state. We've been working on transmission planning through the state of Alaska, and then also Alaska Energy Authority is working closely with Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority on the LNG trucking proposal that is also addressed in other legislation this session. So we are also working on regional energy planning. My predecessor, Steve Haginson, as executive director, had led the effort to develop the energy pathway report for the state of Alaska. That really was a significant inventory of all the variety of resources that were available on a community basis. And what we have done to develop that into more of a statewide planning process is to really look at regional energy solutions and really working with the energy regions of the state and regional leaders such as the Alaska Regional Development Organizations. We've been working with them to really develop and take the pathway to a regional plan. Part of the recognition is the recognition that what could be a solution in the Bethel region is not necessarily a regional solution in Southeast Alaska. It's Mr. Chairman.
Co-Chair Miller.
Sarah, do you think there's a possibility, when that originally came out, we had a disc, it was on disc. Can you get the members a disc so they can kind of go through and see how it was designed and what the effect was of inventorying communities and knowing what the realm of costs and possibilities are for each community? I think it would be helpful for them to have that visual look at how that process went, because it was an amazing process, and it's a really valuable asset to the state, and I think it gets overlooked in conversations on energy.
Madam Co-Chair will definitely provide the report and the disc that goes along with that to the committee.
Thank you.
So some of the large infrastructure that we do own, we do own the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project. That does provide about 10% of the electricity in the Rail Belt area. We also own the Alaska Intertie, which is a connection between Willow and Healy that is a link. It does help unite the Rail Belt system. We are in the process of working with the Rail Belt utilities to help plan a more robust backbone transmission system that would better serve the entire Rail Belt region. And we, of course, are working to develop the licensing of the Susitna-Wautauna Hydroelectric Project. And I know this committee is working on scheduling us to have a more detailed discussion about the Susitna project. So I won't go into any detail with respect to Susitna. However, I'm quite proud of the team and the AEA efforts with respect to where we're at with the project. We did receive the study plan determination for the 44 studies from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That is it's a significant milestone that we've met, and then FERC will be providing a study plan determination for the additional studies in the beginning of April, on April 1st. So again, we'll go into more detail on that at a later date, but I believe things are progressing quite nicely for that project. So rural energy, member of our management team that I do need to mention is Sandra Muller. She is the deputy director of our rural energy programs, and her primary efforts are to really lead up the rural energy infrastructure, which is bulk fuel and rural power system upgrades in rural Alaska. For the last 13 years, we've been making progress on updating this energy infrastructure in rural Alaska. For the first 8 years, it's really been Denali Commission, federally funded programs, and for the last 5 years, the state of Alaska has provided AEA with capital dollars to continue with these upgrades.
Sure.
What about the previous slide? You had the Alaska Intertie and I think the Bradley Lake Hydro. On the Alaska Intertie, it's operated by AEA and Rail Belt Utilities. Do you have a memorandum of agreement or understanding between the Rail Belt Utilities and AEA?
Through the chair, Representative Nagyak, yes, we do. We do have an intertie operating agreement with the Rail Belt Utilities that benefit from that intertie.
And is there any monetary
compensation
or whatever to the Rail Belt Utilities? Or?
Through the chair, Representative Nagyak, the Rail Belt Utilities, through that agreement, are responsible for the operations and maintenance of the intertie. There is no debt associated with that project. There is no profit motive with respect to the Alaska Energy Authority, but the utilities do pay for the operation of that infrastructure.
Thank you. Co-Chair Miller.
Thank you. So going back to Denali Commission, I think one of the things that we need to note also with the Denali Commission is a reduction, a significant reduction in federal funds for the Denali Commission and what that means for the program. We did have a really robust program with Denali Commission on tank farms and access to energy, and so we really have to decide again, are we going to backfill those federal funds that we're not receiving anymore from the Denali Commission? The mission, I don't know if maybe we should have a hearing on Denali Commission too, because it's a pretty fabulous organization based off the Appalachian model of energizing and making things modernized for rural communities. But that's one of the things that is going to be a big stressor on our energy planning in the future, is not having those federal funds in the coordination with the Denali Commission.
Madam Co-Chair, I'd be happy to make sure that we provide some additional information with respect to the Denali Commission. We still are partners with the Denali Commission. The structure that was established and the deficiency list that was provided for the bulk fuel program and the RPSU program is something that we still coordinate and work with them to address the needs of the rural Alaska communities. So I do appreciate that. We do have a significant projects that have been completed with the $300 million of federal dollars that we have spent. But yes, we do recognize that federal reduction in funding.
And so we might be able to cover some of that when we talk about the PC and come back. Representative, we still have, well, we have an hour, so as long as we can get through all of what we really want to get to is the yes. renewable funds. A lot of this is interesting, but if our questions can really allow them to proceed with the presentation.
I just like the before and after pictures. And I guess those, I'm sorry, but those look like ATCO units that were botched in or something, and they're put together someplace and then barged or shipped to the communities?
Through the chair, Representative Nagyak, one of the things that we do is at our warehouse facility in Anchorage, we do a fair amount of the construction of a powerhouse at our facility, and then we do mobilize it and get it shipped out to the rural community.
That's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Successful too.
Very great.
Continue.
Mr. Chairman, in recognition of time, I'm going to skip over the power cost equalization slide and just mention that we do have a loan program, the Power Project Fund, that Alaska Energy Authority does have available for energy projects. And now I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Scaling to discuss the energy conservation program briefly, and then for him to jump into the Renewable Energy Fund program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pleased to talk today because we've got a lot of great results to show. Makes it easier to present. I am going to talk a little bit about the programs that are under my purview, energy efficiency, alternative energy loan program, and then spend most of the time with the Renewable Energy Fund. And at each one of those steps, I've got three take-home messages that I'll pause and highlight, just kind of the main points just to get that through. I do start with energy efficiency and conservation on purpose. It doesn't make a lot of sense to build these big energy systems to provide energy into buildings and structures only to waste it in the structure. And so we tend to keep that in our minds as we go through our programs. First, have energy efficient end uses of the energy, and then provide the energy through efficient diesel powerhouses or renewable energy or whatever the source may be. So AEA's two main programs at the bottom are the Alaska Commercial Energy Audit Program and the Village Energy Efficiency Program. We focus our efforts mostly on commercial and public buildings and small industrial as well. We're very highly coordinated with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, who deals with residential. We share the public space, the public building space, and so we've got a couple of nice programs now, particularly, I think, in the commercial energy audit program, where there's a lot of potential. We really haven't touched many of those commercial buildings yet, and they're big energy users, many of which were built some time ago and don't have very modern controls or systems. So there's an awful lot of opportunity there. In the middle there, I have the akenergyefficiency.org website, which is, and then the partnership logo is up there as well. That's kind of the center of our outreach efforts and planning and coordination, so that everybody in the state that's involved with energy efficiency gets involved with this partnership. We plan together. We get messages aligned so that materials and messages can be distributed to communities, so small communities don't have to keep reinventing what messages work and whatnot. So that's a really nice effort that doesn't cost a lot but has a fairly good impact. And, of course, we're shooting for the state goal set by the legislature and governor of 15% energy efficiency improvement by 2020.
Let me just go back to that bullet on coordination between state agencies. If you could talk about how extensive that is. Are you talking about not just Alaska Housing, but also DNR, Forestry, DEC, that type of thing, where there may be impacts to an energy project across the various departments, or would you explain more of your coordination efforts?
You bet. Mr. Chairman, the connection with AHFC, I was talking specifically about energy efficiency, just because those two state agencies really deal with most of the energy efficiency programs. You know, DNR and some of the others are involved with the energy projects and renewable energy projects, not as much in the energy efficiency realm. And when I'm saying energy efficiency, I guess I could specify it's end-use energy efficiency, typically. End-use meaning the equipment that's using the energy as opposed to the system that's providing it. So, for example, the rural powerhouse program provides supply-side energy efficiency. Those power plants are more efficient, and so every kilowatt hour they deliver into the community is, you know, generated more efficiently. With the Renewable Energy Fund, we do coordinate with DNR. They do a review during, it's a very extensive review process, and they review every application right along with us and provide comments, and that's reflected, their comments are reflected in our review notes. Here are just some quick results on energy efficiency and conservation. We've had a nice influx of the federal stimulus money over the last few years, and we've had some outstanding results coming out of that, despite the fact that it was a very tight time window, and we had very few months to deliver in a lot of communities, 132 communities. I think 122 of those were stimulus funded, and the rest didn't receive stimulus funding but were involved in some other way. And so there are the numbers up there. You can see, you know, $1.5 million dollars, say, projected savings. The nice thing with efficiency is it's immediate. The minute you finish that energy efficiency measure in a building, you're starting to save. And so the 29 cents per dollar invested starts immediately when it leaves off. If it's a loan program, they're often crafted such that you can take out a loan and your immediate savings pays for the loan, and then you still have some left over to pocket until the loan is paid off. And once the loan's paid off, then you receive a lot more.
Of course, I might note that that kind of a loan only works when you have sufficient capital or cash to pay your debt originally. Many times these programs are so necessary in Alaska because people are cash-strapped, their credit denied. They're not able to pay their bills, which is why there's such a huge necessity to bring down the bill. So in a perfect world, this sounds great, but in a real world, many people don't qualify for loans. But I just throw that out.
And I'll clarify, I'm talking about commercial buildings, but the same is true for small commercial. And that's definitely a hurdle that's something to continue to work on. For the sake of speed, I'll keep moving forward. But I guess take-home message number one is energy efficiency is some of the best, most effective money that can be put into energy efficiency, they can put into energy programs. It pays off quickly. The result goes straight to the end user. The energy savings, the dollar savings, goes straight to the end user. And so it's something to keep in mind as we're talking about energy systems. Just a community highlight, Monic got funding from a couple different sources, kind of pooled together in what we call the whole village retrofit. Energy audits were conducted on a whole bunch of public buildings there and then implemented. You can see a nice before and after picture in the public, in the City Hall building. At the bottom, there are some of the results from this program, which the payoff wasn't quite as fast as, I mean, it was all grant funded through stimulus. So it's not like there really is a payoff, but the effectiveness was a little bit lower because the buildings were in such poor shape in some cases, the floor splitting open and drafts coming in, and everybody was very uncomfortable. And so to solve some of the problems, we had to dig a little deeper and fix some root problems as well. We have an annual energy statistics report, which this committee might find some use out of. Focusing on electrical, but all the electrical that's generated, how it's generated, how much is used. There's a wealth of numbers there. If you're ever looking for it, it's on our website, and we'd be happy to provide it. Just a moment on the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, relatively new fund. We're just getting out 16 grants right now from projects that were competitively bid. The way I view this program is it's essentially a stepping stone into the Renewable Energy Fund. The Renewable Energy Fund is really focused on generating cost-effective energy. There are an awful lot of technologies out there that are promising to be commercialized, but they're not quite there yet. And so this program is aimed to get a few of those to commercialization within 5 years. It's not only renewable energy, it's also energy efficiency technologies, storage, energy transmission. It runs the gamut. And it was really interesting to see all the different proposals. In fact, the one we put up there, it's an airborne wind generator. It just has the best picture. Some of them are a little simpler and more straightforward than this, but that's an interesting idea. If you have a place that has low wind speed at the ground, just put that thing up in the air and you can harness wind from up higher because it's generally windy up high. And those programs are actually spread fairly widely across the state.
Representative Hughes.
I'm just curious. Thank you. Is anyone in Alaska looking at the balloon wind turbine, or is that just...
That is one of the projects that's been funded. You say
here in Alaska, that is one?
Yep, that's one of the 16 that made it through the competitive process to be studied.
Oh, okay. What community? I'm just curious.
I think they're still choosing their location. They did have an intent to go into the interior, but I'm guessing they might be looking at costs and looking for someplace else. I can get back to you if you like. So the take-home on the Emerging Energy Technology Fund is a stepping stone to get some more technologies that will help. And there are a lot of small efficiency measures, little technologies that can be widespread, a bunch of renewables, storage. So it's a valuable program, I think, and we're just at the start of that. So Renewable Energy Fund, this is what we're really here for. I guess I'll start with just my own personal comment. As I've been at AEA for several years and on the side and seeing this program running, now that I'm into it, I can see the brilliance of it, and I'm really pretty impressed with the projects that are coming out of it. And my main take home on this one is that these projects really compete with whatever the status quo energy system is. I think I'm not sure everybody recognizes that. It's like, oh, well, wind farm, okay, that looks good, you know, it's renewable. But it's there because it competes. It's lowering costs. So you can see it was started several years ago. Last year, we're in round six now, where we provide a report annually to you, the legislature. That was submitted on January 25. I believe you all have a copy and are familiar with that. The report covers both past projects and then, of course, provides the list, the recommendations for this year. Since it's a recommendation program, we go through a long vetting process to vet the projects, compete them against each other, essentially, and rank them and provide that ranked list to you. So we're in round six, and that's the decision that you have to make during this legislative session. There's some great projects in there.
Representative Higgins?
Just a quick question on alternative energy. When you guys are looking at these programs, do they have to, I guess my question is, it doesn't do us any good to have alternative energy or programs that are being put out there if we can't put the energy on the grid, you know, for whatever mm-hmm. reasons. Mm-hmm. Do you guys look at that and make sure that if you're going to do a 20-megawatt wind farm, we can put 20 megawatts on the grid if it's available before they do it?
Through the chair, Representative Higgins, yes. The applicant is required to own it, have a power sales agreement if they're an independent power producer. The applicants are typically utilities, independent power producers, or some unit of government. Okay.
Right.
So a couple of results are up there in terms of the gallons of diesel that are saved. And I've got a couple other slides coming up on that. So the evaluation process I talked about, it's a strong vetting process. It goes through a four-stage review that's fairly intensive and involves Department of Natural Resources, AEA subject matter experts, independent economic evaluations, and then a ICER third-party review of those to make sure everything, the economics are using a level playing field. So it's quite a robust process.
So in this process, you're also looking, you have the regional spreading in stage four and the technical and economic in stage two. Technical and economic is more of, does this project actually pay off? The step four regional spreading, is that, would you explain that more in, as part of the global application? How does it fit in with other projects and the ability to get best bang for the regional buck?
Yes, I sure can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a good question. So the technical and economic, our recommendations to the legislature is provided in a form like this, where the green tier is the $25 million, the next tier is $50 million. The other ones are, the salmon colored is beyond, is others that are recommended that are beyond $50 million legislative intent, and the white ones are the ones that AEA does not recommend. So in this process, there's a column for the stage two score, which is the technical score. Really, how feasible is this project? Do the economics pencil out? Is there a buyer for the power? Is there a constant supply of energy to supply energy to the system? You know, geothermal, for example, is the resource there, and will it last? So there's quite a scoring criteria that goes behind that, and what we've provided here is just the final score, just so you can see that. Stage three then is essentially the scoring using the statutory guidelines on what to weight, and I should point out that the highest weighted score is the cost of energy. It gets 35 points out of 100, so that's the cost of energy in the region. And so once that rank is set, then we look at how the recommended applications are spread geographically. And essentially, there's, again, a kind of a complex formula behind it all, but what it does functionally is it looks at the regions of the state, the energy regions, that are underrepresented in the fund from year one to until present, and will bump up regions that are underrepresented. And so so that is recognized on this sheet as well.
Representative Higgins and then Representative Josephson. Hughes.
I think I heard you say that ICER does a third-party review, and is that done at, they're doing stage two there of the technical and economic review, and are you doing that in-house as well? So if you could just clarify that, please.
Sure, you bet. Through the chair, Representative Higgins.
Hughes.
I'm just following right along. You don't look at all alike. So we hire economic firms competitively to review, to do an economic analysis of each of these. We have an economic model that they all use, so everybody's on the same playing field. We have an assumption for the cost of energy going into the future. Everybody uses the same. And so what happens is after the economic firms are done with their results, we receive them. We have an economist that reviews them. ICER does a third-party review, essentially just, you know, a verification, a check of the final numbers. So yes, both ICER and us. It gets a lot of scrutiny because the cost-benefit numbers are important.
Is that to this or
to this? And one of the things that I am going to have my staff get to everybody is that LBNA has done some recommendations. LegAud has done some recommendations on HB 152, and we've gone through and made some of those changes that you're talking about now. And Jeff's going to grab HB 152 and HB 306, so people can, so the new members can have a background of what the legislature instituted, not only in expectations for energy, but also how the Renewable Energy Fund has evolved from 2008 to where we are today with the economists. And there are two legislative representatives on the advisory committee. So I just to give you guys a background of, we'll get those bills to you and that legislative audit report on recommendations after the, in 2010, that, I mean, it's a great program.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some housekeeping. The spreadsheet you're looking at, is that in the report from January?
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Continue.
After stage four, the recommendations and the process that we went through goes through the Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee, of which there are now four legislators on that committee, two House, two Senate. And then ultimately, they give their recommendation, and we provide the list to the legislature. And we do that by the 10th day of the session. This is just a map to show generally where the projects are in the Renewable Energy Fund rounds 1 through 5. So not including the recommendations for this year, of course, because we don't know which ones will go through. But it's just interesting to see how diversely spread they are over the state. And then you can see some patterns, too, like wind along the west coast, hydro in southeast and south central, biomass in the interior. And this map is the construction projects that are underway or completed. So more on benefits.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Josephson.
Thank you. These projects are just on state lands?
No, they can be on state, federal, private, as long as they've got rights to the lands.
Right. And if I could. So if it's on federal lands, you go through the NEPA analysis and all of that?
Yes, I believe so. There's yes, there's a lot of scrutiny, and we do work with the agencies.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we part of our grant. Mr. Scaling has done is kind of gone through our analysis of actually recommending to the legislature. Once projects are funded, then we go through a grant process, which is a whole another oversight process that the Alaska Energy Authority has. And your question helps highlight a good point where when we go through a construction project, one of the things that an applicant needs or a grantee at that time needs is site control. So regardless of who owns the land, they need to show and demonstrate that they have the ability to develop the project on the land that they're using.
Thank you.
I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one because I like the graphs and pictures. I hope you do as well. I'll continue on to a couple of the others. I mean, it's essentially, this is reducing the cost of energy in communities. It's levelizing the cost so we're not reliant on the price of fossil fuels coming in, going up, going down, generally up. One major point, the third from the bottom there, is that this process does have this strong vetting process so we can compare projects side by side, and so we know that what's being proposed, what's being recommended are good projects.
Representative Hughes.
Got it right. Thank you, Chair. I'm looking at slide 18, and I know this is just the construction amount, but it looks like most has gone into wind, and I'm wondering if that's because there's been the most interested in that and more applications for that, or are you seeing one of these where the value is seeming to be better, and so you're putting more money into that, or can you just explain why the majority of projects have been wind?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, the wind projects tend to be able to be put up a little bit faster than, say, hydro. Ultimately, the biggest dollars requested have been from hydro projects, but they take a long time to go step by step to get to construction. And we've got a lot of those queued up, but they do take some time to get there.
If we could address this, and Ms. Fisher would step in otherwise, but hydro is also something that is being removed from federal funding opportunities, communities tell me, because it's no longer considered on the federal side as a renewable energy. Maybe you could talk about that, and then go ahead.
But, Mr. Chairman, and to Representative Hughes' question with respect to wind first, I think one of the things that I've observed over the years on the wind projects is that we've had some preliminary work done with federal funds, whether it be Denali Commission or direct U.S. Department of Energy grants that we're providing. We had a lot of data coming in at about the same time that this program was being developed. So in many respects, we had a lot more, in my opinion, shovel-ready type of wind projects that were pretty much ripe for the application process in some of those early rounds with the Renewable Energy Fund. So I think that's one of the reasons that we saw that wind kind of took a bit of a lead. But as Mr. Scaling pointed out, too, those are also some of the projects that are a bit quicker to get up. There's probably less of a permitting process. There is not a FERC requirement process for a wind project as there is, for example, for many of the hydro projects in the state of Alaska. So the hydro, I think, as Mr. Scaling pointed out, and to Representative Hughes' question, too, and to yours, hopefully, Mr. Chairman, is that, yes, there is. It's definitely a longer process to permit and develop a hydro project in the state of Alaska than and anywhere, quite frankly, than it would be for a wind project. So, you know, I think, you know, significantly that's why we're seeing more wind development. In addition, those hydro projects are a lot more expensive at times than a wind project, which can be scaled up or down based upon the number of turbines in the area. A hydro project, you know, this program has some limitations on funding. So we've put caps with our funding costs. Early rounds, it was $2 million for low-cost areas, $4 million for higher-cost areas, and then now we've recently had a $4 million cap for lower-cost areas and an $8 million cap for funding requests. Oftentimes, hydro projects are significantly higher than that, and so entities that are interested in developing those are probably looking for a combination of funding sources, too.
But here's where we get back to my introductory comments on project strategies and policies. A lot of times our projects then inform our strategies. We create strategies just to get our project done, rather than our goal and our policy informing our strategies and projects. If our goal is to have renewable energy, sustainable, long-term, low-cost renewable energy that can be a base load, hydro should be at the top of the list wherever possible, and wind not. Even though wind is easier to facilitate and faster to get up, and more money can be thrown to it real quickly, the problem with wind, it's never a base load, so you're always spinning diesel or something just to make sure that you have a reliable source of energy. So this is part of our dilemma. We can throw money at projects and be happy that we got projects going, but we've not really conquered the goal, and that goal should remain first and foremost. Could you address that?
Mr. Chairman, I think this is where in some of the discussions that we've had over the last couple of days and actually weeks too it's a combination of programs. The Renewable Energy Fund is one strategy that the state of Alaska has funded the Alaska Energy Authority to address development of projects. The Renewable Energy Fund program is really designed to be a bit more locally driven. These are projects where, you know, applications come into us and we evaluate them and fund those projects. Now, the other strategy that the state of Alaska has through AEA is the development of hydro projects by owning and operating. The most significant example at this point is the Susitna-Wautana project. Historically, when the Alaska Energy Authority was established in 1976, the primary goal at that time was really to develop energy projects, in particular develop hydroelectric projects. The Fort Dam Pool projects were developed by the state of Alaska and owned and operated by the Alaska Energy Authority until they were sold to the local utilities in 2000. So I think the issue, and I think what you are getting at, and I think that's where the Alaska Energy Authority's portfolio programs addresses the more of the statewide strategies of energy, is we have different tools available to do this. The Renewable Energy Fund fits one particular strategy and provides a strategy for local development of resources, and we have an oversight process that we use to vet and evaluate these projects. In addition, we also can play a significant role for some of these high capital cost projects that are larger and will serve and benefit a greater portion of the population of the state of Alaska. Again, the example is, of course, building a larger hydro project.
Thank you. Follow up with Co-Chair Millett.
Thanks. And I think it's very valuable to point out, when we did design the Renewable Energy Fund, is not every community is going to have access to hydro. So while hydro is a great investment and something that provides hundreds of years of energy, you're going to go out to Bethel and there's no way that you're going to find a place to put a hydro dam in. So the idea was that whatever works for the community, whatever resources, renewable resources are available, whether it be in-river, hydrokinetic, whether it be wind, whether it be geothermal, because not every community has access to hydro or has the ability to be hooked up via transmission to a hydro project. So I think we need to recognize that the regional balance that we tried to strike in HB 152 recognized that not everybody was going to have the same type of renewable energy. It was what was best for their community, and many communities do not have access to hydropower. So I think that while your point is great, we have to recognize that Bethel is probably going to be better with wind because they don't have high lake dams that they can produce hydro from, and there's other communities such as Kodiak that wind was a great opportunity, and I think they've displaced diesel 95%. So when you look at a renewable energy project, not only are you looking for, and I don't think low cost is what we're trying to get at in every village or every community, because low cost to you and low cost to me is something completely different. But what we are trying to do is, one, displace diesel, and one, have a reliable source of energy. And in every community, it is incredibly different. The dynamics are different. That's why I think it's important that we get Steve Higginson's report out to the committee so they can understand. While we might all want hydro, it's the realistic goals of HB 152 were to provide each community with its individual opportunity.
Right, and hydro is an example. It isn't the sole equation in my reference. My reference is really, let's make sure that as we reach regional or community goals, that number one, if it's a community project, it can have some integration with the region. And number two, that if it's the balance between I can wait a little bit and get lower cost energy, that's a base load, or I can spend the money right now and get something up. This is what we've been facing throughout the state. We've got to be looking strategically, and our policy should inform our projects, not our projects, our strategies. Representative Hughes and then Representative Nagia.
Yes, I recall that the state set a goal to have a certain amount of renewable energy by a certain date. Was it 25% by 2025? That's one question. Then I have another one, so that's just a yes or no. And then I was very intrigued by the chair's comment that the federal government is not considering hydro as renewable. Can you comment on that? And I'm assuming the state still does. And then
let's break the question down. Let's give them an opportunity to answer.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, the renewable energy goal is 50% renewable by 2025. And then with respect to the federal government, there are aspects of the federal government and funding opportunities for renewable projects that do not include hydro as a renewable resource. That is not all projects. I know RUS is a funding source and a potential loan source for hydroelectric projects, but that has been a concern that there is not a federal-wide recognition of hydro as a renewable resource.
Follow up.
So they haven't changed the definition, though. It's just a matter of they're not putting the funding into it. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, it depends on the program, but generally the federal government does not recognize hydro projects, in particular larger hydro projects, as a renewable energy resource. So there is some subtleties and requirements of certain programs. There are some loan programs that do offer assistance for renewable or for hydro projects, but in general the federal government hasn't recognized hydro as a renewable resource. And I believe, if I recall in the past, I think the state legislature has put forth resolutions encouraging the federal government, because hydro has been such a significant lower cost energy resource for the state of Alaska. I think there's been an effort to make sure that, you know, the federal government does recognize that, and the state of Alaska urging the federal government to recognize that.
Every year for the last 10 years we've had a resolution, just to put it on the record.
Hydro is as bad as coal to many environmental concerns.
And follow-up, Chair, and just a question, are any of these areas rising to the top yet it looks like they're going to have the most value as far as bang for the buck? Can you tell that yet with any particular type?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I would have to go back to, and Madam Co-Chair Millett had mentioned the community of Kodiak. I would suggest that the community of Kodiak is the poster community for the Renewable Energy Fund in particular, where they have been able to successfully apply and rank high for hydro project development, which they also currently have the Terror Lake project, which was one of the Fort M Pool projects that the state of Alaska had originally built. But they've provided some addition and increased energy to that project through the Renewable Energy Fund, and have also developed their Pillar Mountain Wind project. So in many respects, I think it's a community that shows a great deal of success, in particular for this Renewable Energy Fund program, but then also renewable energy in general. But I think, again, it also is a recognition of the diversity of our state, the different regions, the fact that Interior Alaska may not have the wind resources, they do have the biomass resource, and so we do have a program that allows the different regions to take advantage, appropriate advantage of the program for the resources that they have. So,
thank you. Mr. Nagyak, and then Mr. Joseph.
Yeah, I know this is about renewable energy, but this discussion, but at some time we need to discuss some places where there are pockets of methane gas, like in my part of the world. Past several years, they did a project in Wainwright, and they concluded that there's plenty of methane gas underneath them that could power their plant or whatever for many, many, many decades. And another one in Point Lea, and I know there's a communities around the rail bed that might have the capability of using methane as a source. And so those are known, but the thing is that we need to invest, maybe start thinking about investing some
and,
of that.
And that'll be answered when you see Pathways. How many of you have not seen Pathways? It's a AEA Energy book, the disc co-chair Millett was talking about. We'll make sure you get that. I thought it was more ubiquitous, but I thought everyone had it on their dining room table. We'll make sure you get that.
One thing, and just so you know, what you all received that I just passed out to you are HB 306, which is the energy policy that was passed 4 years ago, and HB 152 that was passed in, I believe, 2008. And it's important to this committee that you be familiar with both of those. Not only that, we should probably get you the copy of the Emerging Technology Fund bill. I think it was Hospital 206. So you guys can, when we talk about this stuff, it's good to have a historical perspective on what it is. So I would encourage the members, because we do go kind of fast on some of the stuff, but if you would take some time to read those, that would be great for the committee and probably answer a lot of the questions that we do in committee.
Thank you. Mr. Josephson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fisher-Goad, and hopefully the committee will indulge this, just if you could give me just sort of the summary or synopsis. Why does the federal government not recognize hydro as a renewable? And what is the impact? Is it a FERC scrutiny kind of thing, or what?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I guess I'm not certain. I don't want to speculate with respect to in general why the federal government views certain things. But again, I want to make sure too that it is that there are some. There are some financial resources available through the federal government for hydro projects. But I think I don't know, except I think there's a concern that there's a I don't know, maybe it's perhaps more politically correct to support solar PV projects and wind projects with respect to rather than hydro projects. So, but I do know that, you know, through our process and our experience with the Susitna-Watonna project, that, you know, the FERC licensing process and the federal scrutiny in order to seek and license a large hydro project, you go through a tremendous amount of work and detail in order to develop the information that you need to file for a license. So so I guess again, I'm not sure if I could really speculate on that. I think actually Representative Millett is probably best to speak, especially with the research and in the work that's been done for the state of Alaska to really put forth why, you know, the state has had the position that hydro is a renewable resource and should be recognized as one.
Co-Chair Millett, do you want to address that briefly?
I can. So the United States government doesn't recognize hydroelectric because of some of the lawsuits that have happened in Oregon, Washington, and Nevada with respect to dams and reduction in fishing and displacement of recreational land. So there was a big push in Washington, D.C. several years ago when a couple environmental groups sued the federal government, and they took hydroelectric off of the renewable list based on some, you know, poor project planning and impacts to the environment in the lower 48, not talking about, you know, high lake dams like we have in Alaska, but more of the damming of the rivers. And so there was some cases, some indigenous people sued, and so our hydro is much different than what happens in the lower 48 with the way that we have the high lakes and the dams that we do, and the impact is so insignificant to our environment and our fishing industry that we've been a strong proponent. And to the federal government's benefit, they have recognized that Alaska is different and have been very receptive to hydro projects and funding hydro projects and expediting FERC process. So we're in a unique situation compared to the lower 48, where they're damming rivers, and we're not damming rivers. We're using a lot of high lake hydro. So
we're not damming them yet.
I don't think that's a fair comment, because I think we've been pretty cognizant of not we're pretty good at determining that we won't sacrifice one resource for another resource. So,
very well put. Go ahead and continue. We've got, just for housekeeping, about 15 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, sir. I've covered this. Last year, we sought a third-party review of the Renewable Energy Fund. The two reports are now published. One is a process report, and the other is an impact evaluation report. Those are both on our website now. And so the next couple slides will show some of the results found. This one indicates the net present value cost versus net present value benefits received through the program for the first 62 projects that made it to construction. Some of these made it to construction phase even if construction wasn't completed yet. So the take-home here is, essentially the costs are $500 million. The state's cost of that is about $112 million, and that's deriving a benefit of about $1 billion. So put in $1.20 and or $1.12 and get out $10. It's pretty impactful. Here's another one. This is millions of gallons of diesel equivalent saved through the years. So you can see there's a huge difference between 2012 and 2013 that warrants explanation. The 2013 to 15 are projected numbers. However, the 2013 numbers has some projects that just started in December and January, some substantial projects, the Municipal Light and Power landfill gas collection project in Anchorage, Eva Creek Wind is in there, and several other significant projects that are actually producing now at or above the anticipated. So that jump isn't just made up. And in fact, if you look back through history, you'll see we've anticipated that jump for some time, although it's now real. And so this is only the first projects that are underway. As more projects come on, for example, round six, these numbers, the future numbers, will continue to rise. We talked a bunch about PCE today. This is the impact on PCE that the Renewable Energy Fund has had. The largest impact is on the PCE ineligible. So that would be the commercial buildings and any kilowatt hours that are ineligible for PCE. They're seeing the savings through the Renewable Energy Fund. PCE eligible is less so, and the state actually retains, is one of the major recipients of the benefits of the program, essentially savings to the PCE outpayments. This is just one example because we've gotten some questions about, how exactly energy is being saved. On the left side is typical diesel generation. It's the total cost over a 20-year period is combined of fuel costs and non-fuel costs, which are represented there. Wind doesn't have a fuel cost, so that's that bar doesn't need to be there. The wind is free. What you have is a capital expense and then operations and maintenance. So the middle bar is kind of a wind project as constructed, and the one on the right is if the capital expenses of a large majority of it in this example would be paid for by the Renewable Energy Fund. So this is an example of how costs are reduced through Renewable Energy Fund and also made more stable because the cost of fuel isn't rising and falling each year. Here are a couple highlights examples. I talked about the landfill to gas energy project. The landfill produces a lot of methane, which they're regulated and required to not allow it to escape to the environment as methane. So for the last bunch of years, the landfill's been burning it off and essentially just burning it, and the heat goes into the air. Now they're collecting it. It goes through these 20-cylinder gas fired units and is producing energy. It'll produce about 26% of JBear's electrical need through the year. One more highlight, Delta Junction. The school put in a biomass program to provide heat for the school. This is a wood chip
program. The wood chips come from Dry Creek Sawmill, and so it's an additional revenue source for the sawmill, taking a waste product and making something of it. The program's had a big impact on the school, and we've just heard some nice results. So during the first winter, they started September 2011, so we have results from their first winter of heating. It saved them $153,000 and 53,000 gallons in heating, allowed them to save two teacher positions, reopen the music program, and remodel the school kitchen. The facilities guys actually like it. They said it's low maintenance. It's about an hour and a half per week, and they're looking at expanding either this system to provide more heat to other buildings, and they're also interested in a system similar to this for their elementary school. So this is another place where, when they're purchasing the fuel, that money stays pretty local. So that's an additional benefit that's not necessarily recognized by our economic models, because to us in the economic models that looks like an expense, but really it's an expense to somebody else in the community. So it's a nice local presence. And here's one other project, a small hydro project in Atka, recently completed. It's just started generating energy. They're part of that bar that shows the increase in 2013, although a small one because this is a small community and a small project. But it's looking like it's going to be providing about 100% of Atka's energy needs, and they're looking at integrating and selling some of that to the seafood, Atka Pride Seafood as well. You know, simple payback, 21 years, return on investment 139%, local labor. There are just lots of nice examples like this out there, and pretty pictures too. So our recommendations for this year can be looked at in these ways. Recommendations by type, you can see hydro is a huge one, getting to Representative Hughes's question earlier, and then you can see the funding by region. That would be just the round six funding. So hydro is definitely a large contingent this year. In the top 25 million, this is interesting. I should let you know that we do go through a stepwise process. We don't go straight to construction. If somebody comes in with an idea, hey, I've got this great idea, let's construct it, we have them do a feasibility study so that we're sure that it's going to produce energy the way that they're anticipating it does. And so it does take a little while. It's taken a couple of years for some of these projects to get through reconnaissance and feasibility and final design and construction. But now we're seeing more and more. For example, in the top 25 million-dollar tier of recommendations, 16 of them are construction projects. They're out of 23. Two are design, three are feasibility, and two are reconnaissance. So we're pretty heavy-duty into the construction phases now on a lot of these that have been queued up for the past several years.
And Mr. Chairman, the last couple of slides is, just to kind of round out the Alaska Energy Authority programs, that although a significant amount of our conversation this morning has been on the Renewable Energy Fund, we do have other programs that and active projects that do go beyond the Renewable Energy Fund. And we just wanted to give a snapshot of the variety of projects that we're dealing with and the funding that has been provided beyond the Renewable Energy Fund, but with other state funds. So I did want to just highlight that. And then also, all of our programs area-wide, region-wide, and statewide, these are the projects that we've had under construction this last summer. And so it's an opportunity for us to then highlight, too, that we aren't just about trying to license a large hydro project in the rail belt or rail belt issues, that we have a presence statewide and in particular a lot of rural communities with our projects and programs. And it is a legislative session. I felt obligated to at least put our FY14 summary budget request in here for the energy members.
So. Excellent. Any questions by members? This has been a very good wrap-up, some good discussion, definitely highlighted some areas where we as members can study up and have future discussions, and we look forward to you coming back for more of the discussions as we've discussed. And if there is no further business, I don't believe we're going to be meeting this Friday. Our next meeting will be Monday the 11th at 7 p.m. Notice that's a change of time. Everybody knows 7 p.m. We'll be hearing House Bill 35. If there's no further business, I adjourn today's meeting of the House Special Committee at 9:51 a.m.